and streets and buildings and clubs and sandwiches and whatever named after in Israel than anyone else. And that comes from the Israeli newspaper Ydiot Ahronot.
How's it going, guys? Because
we got it?
I think.
All right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the red light's on. Tonight we're going to talk about American Zionism. Everything we've talked about so far has been a uniquely European slash Middle Eastern experience. And American Zionism differs in substantial ways, and it made a substantial impact. It's on. Oh, got to speak into the microphone. Some but not all of what I'm talking about tonight comes from this book. This is really the best on the topic. It's called American Zionism from Herzl to the Holocaust. And I'll leave it out here. It's by a wonderful scholar named Melvin Urofsky, Urofsky. And he's a premier American Jewish historian. And this is really a really excellent book. Like most of the books that I use for this course, it's pretty much too detailed on one subject to assign as a general reading, but I always like to give you an opportunity to learn a little more if you want. So it's a great, great book to have.
Didn't he write the definitive biography of Brandeis? I think this
Urofsky, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. See, I haven't read that for a long time. Okay, and that was a relatively short piece. Virtual Jewish Library, by the way, is a wonderful website with tons of stuff. You know, when you spend a lot of time trolling around the internet, as I do, you find presidential papers and a lot of junk. And you have to learn how to differentiate. Some of the presidential papers come across as being some junk. You know, I think all of Eisenhower's stuff is public access. Just depends on how sophisticated the presidential libraries are. But there's a lot out there, and you learn quickly how to differentiate between what's good and accurate and not so good. For example, Wikipedia, you pretty much need to know what you're talking about to understand if it's accurate or not. But things like the Jewish Virtual Library, they've been vetted by professional historians. Some of it's very detailed, some of it's, you know, just gives you a quick hit and all types of good things. Just jewishvirtuallibrary.com. All right, so we're going to start out with American Zionism. And actually, before I bring up a chart of differences, I want to ask you guys, can you think of or imagine any ways in which American Zionism was different than the European flavors of Zionism, or European Zionism?
It was not intended to be a sanctuary for American Jews.
Right. American Jews weren't, there was no emphasis on Aliyah. And in fact, there was some reticence and some fighting of that at various points in history as well. It's beyond the scope of what we talk about, but in 1950, David Ben-Gurion and Blaustein, first name?
Jacob
Blaustein, thank you. Jacob Blaustein from Baltimore, whose house was not far from here actually, had signed an agreement, and in part of the agreement was that Israel wouldn't ask American Jews to make Aliyah. So it was to continue that strain through American Jewish history. Anything else? Anything else? Jill?
It was mainly
a fundraising. Was one of two principal goals. We'll see what the other one was, absolutely.
I was surprised that in the beginning, say until the 1910 and 1915, most American Jews did not support the idea of Zionism.
Zionism did not take off until Louis Brandeis came on the scene. There was a handful, including some in Baltimore. Baltimore has a nice role in early Zionist history that we'll talk about a little bit. But it really was Brandeis who we'll go into in detail. Really about 1912, 1913, he comes on the scene. Anything else? Jill again.
There were a lot of
women players a little later because of Henrietta Tsold and Hadassah. It really became the principal vehicle for internationalism for American Jewish women versus the men who also had the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee that did rescue and relief work overseas and some other groups that were doing that.
I think there also seemed to be an emphasis on sort of recreating the American experience. I mean, having a country that had the same sort of civil liberties and sense of patriotism and pioneer spirit, mm-hmm. almost like the Arabs were equivalent to the Indians. And
mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, it was totally framed in the American experience for American Jews to help them digest it. And in part, that's because a lot of it was geared initially toward getting the establishment Jews and background ethnically, who were the establishment Jews?
Germans,
right. The Eastern Europeans came with their innate feeling for it, and that would create tensions as well. Did you have your hand up
again? Just as a corollary to what you were saying is the idea of dual loyalty. you know, can you be loyal to the United States as an American citizen and also be loyal to Zionism?
That was definitely a big question that the early people, such as Brandeis, had to address, and he addressed it masterfully.
They were also hoping that the Jews would identify more with Judaism. They were
the early Zionists?
Becoming more assimilated in America. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's been said, we mentioned it before, you're right, Mr. Max, that in this class we've mentioned that Zionism became Judaism for certain people, right? They weren't religious in America, but they latched onto Zionism. And we saw that even more so in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, in large regard. But there was some of that then as well.
The Pushka.
The Pushka was, everybody had the Pushka, right? Everybody. I think I told you guys the story. My mother always put a nickel in when I had a test. You know, and it's funny, we have Pushkas in the house, but we don't really use them. You know, they're more kind of decoration pieces than anything else. Pushka being the JNF blue box. All right, anything else? All right, excellent, excellent. Let's take a look. And see, I came up with 9 total. And let's detail them real quickly. Never quite sure when this is going to time me out. There we go. All right, how American Zionism differed. Little or no emphasis on Aliyah. The Europeans, almost all of them in some sense, talked about Aliyah, moving to Israel, the land of Israel. Even the cultural Zionists said, we don't want a state now, we want it down the road, we're not ready for it, but eventually we're going to be going there. So there was an understanding by the Europeans who were Zionists that Europe was not the homeland. Europe is not going to be our last stop. Number 2, the main focus was raising money, we said. I think Jill had said that. And political lobbying. There was no political lobbying in Europe because there was no AIPAC or Jewish Council for Public Affairs or anything like that because, you know, you were just trying to stay away from the authorities, particularly if you were in the Russian Empire. So that wasn't going to be. But when it came to this country, there was staunch political lobbying in large part because there was democracy and there were votes and you were concentrated in certain areas and you donated money to political campaigns. And boy, that hasn't changed at all, has it? Exactly, that's the American system. And these Americans, particularly the elites, learned how to work that system pretty quickly. Number 3, didn't have prominent strands such as political versus cultural and religious Zionism was very small. In fact, American Jews were going to see early on were through Brandeis, particularly after World War I, were practical Zionists, which meant building the land of Israel. That doesn't mean that there weren't political Zionists, which they were at first. That doesn't mean there weren't some cultural Zionists. Religious Zionism was relatively small because the religious community was relatively small. The closest thing we're going to get to it is the conservative movement and Solomon Schechter, and we're going to look at a quote from him and what it had to say. But it's hard to say then as well as now that everybody who was a conservative Jew was religious, right? I consider myself a conservative Jew, whatever that means. I don't necessarily consider myself religious in some ways. In other ways, I am. America is a beautiful land of choice. Number 4, American Jews didn't have an intellectual core reading Hebrew. Remember how the proto-Zionists started these journals, HaMa'asif and other publications? They were the Maskilim, they were influencing one another through their writings in Hebrew. There were Hebrew newspapers that started coming out. Echad HaAm was writing in Hebrew. You couldn't do that in America. There were very few people in America that were Hebrew literate. They weren't as close to the core of Jewish learning as were the Jews still in the motherland. Number 5, Zionist youth groups were nowhere near as popular here. There were some Zionist youth groups, but they were nothing compared to what Beitar was that we talked about last time. I think we talked there were 70,000 Beitar members, I think it was in the mid-20s in Europe, mid to late 20s, and 40,000 of them were in Poland. And then there were all the liberal Zionist groups, Shomer HaTzair and others. Nothing like that in this country, although remnants of it. 6, European Jews talked about making Aliyah. We covered the, double dipping. I guess they really liked Aliyah. 7, European Zionist groups spoke of the ultimate disappearance of the diaspora. We talked about Jacob Klatskin and others who came up with theories of the negation of the diaspora. Eventually, the settlement in the land of Israel is going to grow and grow and grow, and the Jews in the diaspora are going to be wiped out by anti-Semitism or assimilation. It's a double-edged sword. And we had a little conversation here, and one of the things we said is that assimilation seems to be taking its toll here along those lines. What are we going to look like in 100 years? That was, by the way, before I heard this statistic earlier at the end of last week, that you know how many Hasidic Jews are in Brooklyn? Anybody, any guess?
250,000.
300,000. 300, yeah, 300,000. It's amazing. So some Jews are going to disappear, you know, but at this rate and with things that are going on now. But
just in Brooklyn?
Just in Brooklyn.
In three blocks.
That's right. Right, and that's two families. Right? They're all cousins. That's what I read. I was stunned. Anti-Semitism, not a stated issue for American Jews. There was anti-Semitism in this country. We had Father Coughlin in the 1930s. We had Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent in the 1920s and 1930s. But that was nothing compared to anti-Semitism in the old country, where there were actual pogroms going on. And there were. I had breakfast with a Holocaust survivor this morning. He was telling me about how there were actual pogroms after the war in Poland. So, you know, it was deep and broad there. And finally, American Jews had Protestant Christian allies. There were some in Britain, we talked about that, Lloyd George, certainly Lord Balfour, but on the continent of Europe, there really weren't any Protestant allies. The Protestants were concentrated really in the German-speaking lands, and there was a level of anti-Semitism there that precluded that. But in this country, there was always a sense, particularly amongst the evangelical churches, which were a lot smaller then. Anybody remember from week one how many, this will be a good one if you can get it, how many evangelical Christians are in this country, roughly?
65 million.
Bingo. All right.
He's part of that group.
Yes, sir. Bingo. That's fantastic. You don't have that association we're not going to talk about it tonight, but there was a guy named William Blackstone in the 1890s sent something called, we'll talk about it briefly, the Blackstone Memorial, and had it published in the New York Times. It was a listing of about 300 prominent Americans, many of whom were evangelicals and many of whom were not, that he got to sign a piece of paper saying that they believed that eventually Jews should be restored to Zion. And he got future President Harding to sign on to that as well. So there's a whole nice history about evangelicals in this country and their efforts. All right, so those are nine ways that American Zionism differed. And it really was different, and it had to be different, because American Judaism was different. American Judaism had a little bit of people from here, a little bit of people from there. There were different waves of immigration. Everything was new. All the organizations were new. The money was new. And there were some Jews who became fabulously wealthy. Not a lot, but a handful. And they sat at the top of the pyramid. People like Oscar Strauss, people who ran the department stores. You know, in Baltimore, if you're from here, you have the Heck Company, Hochul and Cohn, and Hustlers, right? And the Stork Company also, right? These are all the department stores in town were owned by German Jews, all of them. You have Mr. Blaustein, who invented a small thing called octane oil with his father, you know, so,
American
and they...
American Oil Company.
Yeah, standard oil.
The
yeah.
Who did the gas pump?
Yeah.
They cut off automatically.
Yeah, they
with the
yeah.
Air stations.
And they created no lead octane gasoline as well. They patented many things. The service stations, we know it. I don't know if they patented that, but they invented it. As Jews were making their mark, they had to figure out how Jewish they wanted to be. And then this thing called Zionism came on the scene, and it was very controversial at first, as we're going to see. And again, very, very different. All right, now I want to talk briefly about things that it had in common with European Zionism. Any thoughts? Things that are in common between American Zionism and European Zionism.
Discounting of the problem posed by Arabs.
Absolutely, absolutely. Brandeis basically didn't pay attention at all to that. Very few did. And in large part, that's because there were no Zionist intellectuals in this country. Right? The Zionist intellectuals were in Europe or they were in Palestine itself. When there were Zionist intellectuals here, they were kicked out of Palestine by the Turks at the beginning of World War I. you know, people like Ben-Gurion, people like Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, that were stationed in New York City, who were starting to make fundraising tours throughout the country.
It would also be said that we're much farther away from it, so our knowledge of it is not as great as relative to the Arab Jew situation at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also because remember how up to 50%, if not more, at times of the original Olim, people who made Aliyah, came back. Right, so they were able to talk. So many people were able to talk to people who had lived in Palestine for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years mm-hmm. or something like that. You didn't have that in this country. The only means of expressing yourself in this country was through financial donation or lobbying. And the lobbying, basically, you did because somebody famous said that this is something that you should do. You went to a meeting and you heard it, and that's what you did. All right, a couple things. Both saw themselves as being vital to the movement. And in fact, we're going to see between Weizmann and Brandeis, it was a clash between Europe and America. So the Americans came in a little later and quickly felt that they were the ones who should be leading the Zionist movement. They took their very American approach and spirit to it. Both had enemies within their Jewish community. In Europe, they had the Bund, or the socialists who weren't Zionists. They also had a group called the Autonomists. Anybody remember the Autonomists? I think we briefly mentioned them. Autonomists were led by a guy named Simon Dubnow. Some of you might have heard of him. He's a famous Jewish historian. Dubnow basically said that Jews in Eastern Europe should have autonomy in certain regions and be able to send people to parliaments just the way the Magyars are able to send people to parliament in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Czechs are, or the Slavs are, or whatever. There should be Jewish representatives, and they'll be semi-autonomous within those regions. So they were going to make their home there, and Yiddish would be their language. Anybody know who the enemies were in the United States for the Zionists within the Jewish community?
Assimilation.
That's part of it.
Many of the major Reform rabbis.
Almost all the major Reform rabbis. Don't be kind. They were on record about it, too. And we're going to get to that. And then, of course, there were the traditional Orthodox. What were the traditional Orthodox upset about?
Yeah.
No Messiah, baby. Yeah. Not making the move. I'm not signing the deed until the Messiah shows up and co-signs for me. So there were enemies in both places of this movement. It didn't just happen unopposed. Now, there was something else in common that both shared. Palestinian Jews thought that both groups weren't doing enough. Right? Particularly as the Palestinian Jewish community started growing with the second Aliyah, and again, we go back to Ben-Gurion and other people, they would eventually start saying, you guys really have no idea what you're talking about. We're the ones living the dream, and it's not so easy a dream. Let us do what we need to do. You just send us your money and kind of be quiet. And I could certainly make the argument that some people who live in Israel today feel that way. Right? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I get you.
Yeah, right. Yes. I've met your daughter-in-law. Hardly an opinion goes by. All right. Both also had to fit their Zionist ideology into their greater ideology and philosophy of what it meant to be a Jew in the modern world. And we talked about that a few moments ago with the Americans and the Europeans. But both of them had to have that same approach. All right. Any questions until now? All right. So just as with our general Zionist movement, we have proto-Zionists. And the proto-Zionist that comes to mind for our lecture tonight is Emma Lazarus. And some people know Emma Lazarus for another reason. Is anyone better than me, and can they actually recite her poem, The New Colossus? Because I'm bad at poetry.
What?
The Statue of Liberty. Can you retire your word? Huddled masses.
The wretched refuse of your teeming shores, send these, the homeless tempest tossed.
Excellent. I can't memorize poetry to save my life. Very
impressed.
So that's the poem, The New Colossus, on the Statue of Liberty. Emma Lazarus was a Sephardi Jew. She was also a proto-Zionist. Proto, of course, meaning coming before. And we had many of those in Europe as well. Let me give you a quick background on her, and then we're going to look at another one of her poems, which is really her most well-known Jewish/Zionist poem. She, very much like Rachel, the poetress from Israel that we spoke about when we looked at her poetry, she died way too young. You know, she was very productive, and her life was cut short. She lived from 1849 to 1887. Like I said, she was a Sephardi Jew. From an early age, she studied both American and British literature. So she was really into poetry from the start. She was taught herself and also studied languages. In addition to English, she did some German, French, and Italian. So she's fitting right in home with our proto-Zionists. Her writing attracted the attention of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Not so bad. They started a correspondence that they continued until her death. She also wrote, in addition to many poems, she wrote a novel and two plays. And she traveled a great deal as well. She became more interested in Judaism after reading George Eliot's novel, Daniel Deronda. Anybody ever read Daniel Deronda? So can you give us, it's a complicated plot. Can you give us a quick plot summary, if you recall? Okay, it's a complicated.
I mean, no one else is ready. You can say anything.
Yeah, that's right. So Scooby Dooby Doo came in on a surfboard. So it's a complicated plot. Daniel, to make a very long story short and leave out most major details, Daniel Deronda is raised as a non-Jew. He befriends a Jew who has a dream of returning Jews to the Holy Land. The Jew dies. On his deathbed, Deronda learns that that Jew's deathbed, Deronda learns that he in fact is Jewish, and he is able to fall in love with and marry this other woman, and he has mixed emotions and all this, and it's very complicated. Some people say it's one of the finest of romantic novels of Elizabethan England. It's considered one of the greats of British literature. I have never read the complete book. I've seen excerpts of it, and it's, you know, like I said, a complicated plot. She gets more interested in Judaism from reading that. Then she hears about the pogroms in 1881 in Russia. So this is very familiar to what happened to a lot of our Zionists in Europe. The pogroms shocked them out of their feeling that everything was going to be okay, and this was a land where they could assimilate. The pogroms brought Russian Jews to New York City, whom she started meeting and integrating with. She started teaching them in night schools. Who else did that? Anyone remember? Henrietta Zold, right? She started a night school, actually, for the Russian Jewish immigrants here in Baltimore. So she began teaching them English. She helped establish for them something called the Hebrew Technical Institute, where vocational training was taking place. Now, she eventually, in 1887, she died, which was likely from Hodgkin's disease, from the symptoms, what we have now. She wrote a number of poems that were considered Zionist, or looked upon as Zionist today. In 1882, she wrote something called Song of a Semite, in which she argued of the need for a Jewish state. This is 1882, just after the pogroms. In another one called The Jewish Problem, she writes, quote, "All suggested solutions other than this of the Jewish people are but temporary palliatives." Then she writes an essay called Epistle to the Hebrews. An epistle is just kind of a...
letter. It's a letter.
Yeah, it's a long... but it's really kind of a statement as well. Maimonides has this famous epistle to the Jews, to the Yemenite Jews. She writes of, quote, "the signs of momentous fermentation and the prophetic intuition of the revival of the idea of a restoration." So for her, this was a glorious, sweeping thing. It was something that fit into the grand sweep of history that she tried to capture in her poetry. And there was no Zionist address for her to go to or to share with. She also wrote a poem called The Feast of Lights, which was about the Maccabean Revolt, obviously. "To wake and to recall today the glorious Maccabean rage, to chant psalms of victory till the heart takes fire, the Maccabean spirit leap newborn." And then she wrote her most passionate one, called The New Ezekiel. And let's see. Oh, here, it's right on here. "What can these dead bones live whose sap is dried by 20 scorching centuries of wrong? Is this the house of Israel whose pride is as a tale that's told in ancient song? Are these ignoble relics all that live of psalmist, priest, and prophet? Can the breath of very heaven bid these bones revive? Open the graves and clothe the ribs of death. Yea, prophecy the Lord hath said, again say to the wind, come forth and breathe afresh, even that they may live upon those slain, and bone to bone shall leap, and flesh to flesh. The spirit is not dead. Proclaim the world. Where lay dead bones, a host of armed men stand. I ope your graves, my people, saith the Lord, and I shall place you living in your land. What is she saying there? What is that mimicking?
Damn good question.
Don't be when the Messiah comes.
Valley of the dry bones. Ezekiel, right? The hip bone's connected to the thigh bone. And so on and so on. She's putting that in words of, you know, messianic redemption. And, you know, it's one of the things I like about this poem, in addition to the fact it's beautiful, is that it initially was written in English, so we're not getting the translation. This is really what she meant. And she was very powerful in her writings. And obviously, you know, was chosen to be on the Statue of Liberty, which is no small honor. All right. Oh, she, by the way, though, has to say that it's not for everybody, right? She does this too. There is not the slightest necessity for an American Jew, the free citizen of a republic, to rest his hopes upon the foundation of any other nationality so ever. Rather, Zionism is meant for the East European Jews. In other words, we're at home. Don't worry about it. Because their colonization en masse in the United States is impracticable. The plea for the establishment of a free Jewish state is not the remotest bearing of the upon the position of American Jews. For wherever we are free, we are at home. The last thing American Jews wanted to do, all the way throughout the Zionist experience, was to bring the Eastern European Jews to this country, particularly if you lived in New York City, where they were beginning to crowd into the Lower East Side, and there was rumors about the mafia, and, you know, the filth, and the decadence, and the what have you. Their goal in working with Zionism was to give the wretched masses not a place to come onto these shores, but to go over to those shores and to help them out in doing it. And that was even more so the case with the German Jews. The Sephardi Jews, however, came first, right? They were the most established if they hadn't assimilated out by now. And I can't remember which generation of her family came to this country. Did anybody know anything on that? Okay. It's something I should try and look up. All right. Any questions? Good. So let's dig a little now into the organizational aspect of American Zionism and Judaism. The first known usage of the Zionist flag came in this country. The Zionist flag being the one with the Star of David and the two blue stripes on it. That doesn't mean that it was the first usage, because it had to come from somewhere, but this is the first recorded usage as of today. It was on July 24th in 1891 at the dedication of Zion Hall in Boston. So we're already seeing seeds of pro-Zionist groups in this country. Most of them Hovei Tzion Zionist groups, because political Zionism wasn't even invented yet. It doesn't get invented until Herzl publishes The Jewish State in 1896. It's the blue and white flag, like I said, with the Star of David, but it's got the Hebrew word Maccabee on it as well. All right? And we talked in one of our earlier meetings about the importance of the Maccabees as a symbol, and Hanukkah as a symbol to the early Zionists. It was unfurled at the B'nai Zion Educational Society. B'nai Zion meaning the children of Zion. It was referred to as the flag of Judah. It was designed by someone named Jacob Asquith and his son Charles. And the blue, anybody know why it's blue? Same reason the talus is often blue. You're close. Yeah, that's right. The Tehelet, it's called. It's the blue indigo dye from a snail. Say again?
From a snail.
Yeah, from a snail that's mentioned in the Torah. That it's going to blue blue. Anybody know, this is the tricky question. Anybody know what the two stripes are for? There's two reasonings that things what the two stripes are for. Any thoughts? Some just say it's for the talus, right? Because talus often has stripes on it. Now, if you're Jabotinsky and the revisionists, it's the Nile and the Euphrates. because that's one of the biblical definitions of the borders of Israel. It's not the broader accepted one, but that's one of the definitions. And the Palestinians often point to that, and they say, even your flag tells us about your expansionist desires. So that's, and some people would agree to that, right? Remember, Jabotinsky wanted the East Bank of the Jordan River, too, right? I don't know, you know, pretty desolate land, but I guess he had his reasons. All right, let's talk for a moment. We're going to come back to the organizational in a bit. Talk for a moment about the opposition that was in this country to Zionism, because it was pretty strong. The reform movement was guided by something called the Pittsburgh Platform. The Pittsburgh Platform was its statement of belief, let me get a little space there, from 1885, group of about 25 reform rabbis, remember we're not talking about a huge American Jewish community at this point, gathered in Pittsburgh, and they felt that there needed to be a new credo that would come out to tell everybody what they believed in. This was something where they basically said, we're American, we give up believing in miracles, we give up believing in a deity that can interfere in our personal lives. They Protestantized Judaism. They made it a religion. They didn't make it a way of life. And this is what they had to say about nationhood and nationalism. Can I get someone to read that? Any volunteers? Don't.
We recognize in the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect the approaching of the realization of the approaching of Israel as a great messianic hope for the establishment of a kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among all men. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, nor sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state.
Okay, so we're not going to worry about kashrut, we're going to worry about social action. Right? This is where this starts. This drives the reform movement for another 40 or so years. This is basically the credo that all reform rabbis are told to uphold, even though increasingly some of them won't do it. But it's a very interesting and important document in American Jewish history. By the way, they did other things, like they called this, what did they call the synagogue?
Temple.
Why'd they call it a temple? Because they don't want to rebuild the temple anymore. They have their temple, right? And that lasts until today, right, in terms of the terminology. Reform Jews said, you know, we're taking certain things out of the prayer book. The traditional prayer book, at the end of the Amidah, there's a little prayer that says, you know, and may we witness the rebuilding of the temple in our days. Well, that's out of the conservative prayer book now, too, but there are other prayers that refer to it in conservative liturgy. But it's certainly out of the Reform prayer book. And they did everything they could to make Judaism just make it a little different in that it was Jewish. It wasn't Protestant, but it was very close to it. And this was being mirrored in terms of what was going on in Germany as well. In fact, they were catching up to Germany, and a number of these rabbis who formulated this were from Germany as well. Places like Baltimore Hebrew Congregation were starting to switch from Orthodoxy over to Reform at that point. Almost every congregation in this country started Orthodox. Very few actually started Reform that were in operation at that time. But they switched over, and there was no conservative as a way station in between. That really didn't take off until the early 1900s.
Didn't Bethel start as a conservative, though?
Bethel started as conservative as a breakoff from Bethphila.
Yeah.
Right, because they wanted to give a home to Rabbi Agus. And Bethphila is ideologically very different because it's on the left wing of the conservative movement. I know of no other conservative congregation within Oregon, for example. I mean, anybody ever been to one? What?
I said, we started as members of Bethel, and Oregon drove me crazy.
You mean Orthodox? I mean, you said conservative.
Conservative.
Yeah, I know of no other conservative congregations other than Bethel that has an Oregon. Which Bethel has?
I had one growing up.
Did you? A conservative?
Conservative? Yeah.
That's very unusual. It really is. You know, and I would think it might be more of a Southern thing because there might be more leanings toward liberalism and reform in the South. Do you know how old the congregation is? That's interesting. That's
as old as, what was the other one, Bethel, right?
Bethel did not.
Yeah, Bethel was the old one.
Interesting. All right. By 1937, this was overruled by the Columbus platform in the reform movement. And we're going to talk about why in a minute, but can I get someone to read that? A different volunteer. Don't make me call on somebody, yeah?
In all lands where our people live, they assume and seek to share loyalty. Loyally, the full duties and responsibilities of citizenship and to create seats of Jewish knowledge and religion. In the rehabilitation of Palestine, land hallowed by memories and hopes, we behold the promise of renewed life for many of our brethren. We affirm the obligation of all Jewry to aid in its upbuilding as a Jewish homeland by endeavoring to make it not only a haven of refuge from the oppressed, but also a center of Jewish culture and spiritual life.
Okay, so what's being said here that wasn't said before?
Refuge.
It's a refuge. So what's going on? Why are they using that word?
Europe.
It's 1937.
Europe.
Hmm?
Europe.
Exactly, exactly. What else is going on that's changing in the Reform movement? Any other thoughts?
Younger rabbis.
Definitely younger rabbis.
Stephen Wise.
Rabbi Stephen Wise. He's by 37. He's not so young anymore.
Well, yeah.
Right. He's at the second Zionist Congress in 98. Right. Right.
Are they also American born?
Absolutely. Almost all American born at this point. Almost all American born at this point. You also have the fact that the Reform movement is changing dramatically, because the Reform movement is starting to get the children of the Eastern European immigrants as members. And they are more traditional oriented, and that does more to change the Reform movement than anything else. In fact, the vast majority of American Judaism is now children or immigrants from Eastern Europe. The German Jews have basically been pushed aside, the Sephardim have been pushed aside a long time ago, and that's come down to be that way to this very day. Right? I mean, in this room, sorry if I'm embarrassing anybody, raise your hand if you're of Eastern European stock. Well, there you go. You're not of Eastern European stock? Where's your family from originally?
I converted, so from Italy.
Okay, no, okay, that's cool though. So there's a big Sephardic community, you never know. You never know. Shmuel, the great Shadal, Shmuel David Lozado, one of the great rabbis. Did you ever get to talk to Rabbi Loeb about Italy?
No.
That's a shame. That's a shame. That was one of his real areas of expertise.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Because of his love of the opera, and he visited Italy all the time. All right, great. All right, so what else was going on then? The spike of anti-Semitism we talked about. There's also something going on. There are facts on the ground in the Yishuv. There is now, as it says, a place where Jews are living. Right? This isn't just a place of refuge anymore. This is a place where Jewish scholarship is coming out of. It's influencing people. Some Reform rabbis who are very scholarly have gone there. They've studied with Gershom Shalom and some others who are, you know, very prominent in their fields, or they've met them on tours to the United States. The Yishuv by 1937 is part and parcel of the world Jewish community. We have roughly, I'm going to say, about 350,000 Jews there by then. It's now a sizable Jewish community, by any stretch of the imagination.
How many were here at that time?
In this country, roughly 4.5 million, roughly. I mean, immigration had pretty much stopped. There's a bump in immigration in this country after the war, and then there's another bump in immigration from Soviet Jewry in the 70s and the 1990s. By the way, that's one of the things that are most concerned to American Jewish demographers, that there's going to be no more waves of immigration to this country. Right? That and same thing in Israel, too. One of the things that pushed off the Arab question in Israel to an extent is the Russian immigration. Because percentage-wise, all of a sudden, more and more people were Jewish. So that natural wave of very modern Jewish history, we believe, is at an end at this point, in any significant number.
All the Jews from Singapore already.
Yeah, both of them.
I hear there's some Ukrainian Jews looking for new places.
Yeah, right.
How many Russians emigrated to Israel?
About a million came between 1989 and the year 2000. About a million. I don't have the exact statistics.
The other thing is the Israelis are prolific in childbearing.
Much more so. They have they have a higher birth rate than American Jews do.
Yeah.
American Jews have a birth rate of about 1.7.
Yeah, and I think Israel's probably pushing 4.
It could be, and if you talk about the Orthodox community, it's even higher. But even in the non-Orthodox community, it's 3.5 or something like that. I haven't seen those stats for a while, but I know it's somewhere around there. All right. Let's go back to our... that was a quick timeout to let you know. Oh, of course, when we talked about the more traditional-oriented congregations wanted to hear nothing of this Zionism. I didn't even bother to find quotes on that because you know exactly what they're going to say. And they're saying the same thing today. I read in the Jerusalem Post today that on Purim there was a Purim outing or parade in Brooklyn from the Satmar Hasidim, and as they did every year, they burned the Israeli flag. So, you know, whoop-de-doo. So I guess they're not giving to the United Israel Appeal this year, once again. All right. There were organizational stirrings in this country by the early 1890s. There were small groups of Hobov Etzion, like-minded, pro-restoration, I guess we'll call it, groups of Jews who were meeting. There were a handful of Jews who were struggling to learn Hebrew or speak Hebrew, modern Hebrew. Remember, Eliezer Ben Yehuda wasn't even finished his dictionary, although he started it in the early 1880s. The earliest known organized group we have is in Chicago in 1895. It's called the Chicago Zion Society. And then it became the Knights of Zion, with a K, of course. Now, a little confusion came in my research. They have a gentleman named Leon Zlotkov, who Chicago websites say was the first and only American delegate to the Zionist Congress. I found a Chicago Historical Society website to the Zionist Convention in Basel, yeah, in 1897. However, I found numerous other references, including in this book, to a Baltimore guy named Rabbi Dr. Shepsel Schaefer, because I'm going to spell that, S-H-E-P-S-E-L, and then Schaefer, probably not of the beer family, S-C-H-A-F-F-E-R. He was listed as one of 4 Americans who were at the convention, but someone else listed him as the only voting member. So I can't give you a definitive answer because I have reputable sources which are saying different things. I know for sure that Rabbi Shepsel Schaefer was there, and he was a voting member. He was the rabbi of Congregation Sherith Israel, which is, I can't even remember what that merged into, but I've heard of it before. This was in, he came in 1893. The interesting thing is that it was an Orthodox congregation, and he was an Orthodox rabbi, and he was a Zionist. Highly unusual. Shortly after arriving in Baltimore, a number of congregants approached him and said, we'd like to get together with you, have a meeting, and talk about forming a Zionist society. And they didn't call it Zionist Society at that point. I don't know what they called it, you know, a society to promote the reintegration of Jews into the Holy Land or something like that. That began the start of the Baltimore Hobov Etzion chapter. Right? Does anybody remember where Hobov Etzion fits on the spectrum? Political, practical, cultural, religious? Any thoughts? I'll give you a hint. Echad Ha'am was a Hobov Etzion guy.
Cultural.
There you go. Excellent. Jill, we can give a test. We can give an exam. I don't see why. At least assign papers.
Do we get to choose who we sit next to?
And we hand out mirrors also.
I thought you were only counting perfect attendance.
That's right. The rules change.
There we go.
The rules change. All right. Dr. Israel Fine, who was then at the Baltimore Hebrew College through the 1930s through the 60s, I think, says that this was the first Hobov Etzion chapter in the country. And Baltimore, you know, again, plays an important role in the history of Zionism in this country. After that, we're going to have Henrietta Itzold, then we're going to wind up having people like Shoshana Carden, It really is a very nice, substantial history that's taken place in this community. Our membership grew. Within a few years, they had 300 members. Right? I don't know what they paid. They paid whatever the equivalent of a shekel was in those days. You know, a dime, a nickel, something like that. I'm not sure. They regularly sent money to the settlement of Mishmar HaYarden and a school in Jaffa. And Yerofsky points that out as the first time American Jews send money to the land of Israel that is not for the traditional, you know, yeshiva in the old city of Jerusalem, for the, one of the modern settlement enterprises. So in 1901, we know he went back for the Fifth Zionist Congress. And in 1913, he was one of the people behind the new Mizrahi Zionist organization. Anybody remember what Mizrahi was?
East.
Yeah, that's what it means. But that was the religious Zionist group. And in fact, Rabbi Rosenblatt at Beth Tefillah was national president of that at one point. He wrote a history of it, which I read a number of years ago, of the early days of the Mizrahi movement. I found it, Joe, one day when I was going through the stacks at Baltimore Hebrew. You know, just every now and then would go through there and find something neat to read. So it was, you know, I know, I just don't get over there enough. It costs me to park now, that's the problem.
Is that what they call Amit today?
No, Amit is another group. That's the pioneer women. And that's one of the people that was involved with, that we talked about with the women's group. That was the American offshoot of one of the Israeli groups. I think Hamoetzet HaNashim, the Women's Council. But Amit still has a small presence today. They're bigger in places like South Africa and England. Amit and Naamat also.
Naamat, yeah.
Yeah. Naamat is pioneer women.
Yes,
yeah,
Naamat.
That's it.
Yeah.
And Amit still has a small Baltimore chapter, from what I recall.
Yeah, there is a chapter.
Yeah, it's very small. It's very, very small. All right. Next, in 1897, comes the Federation of Zionist Societies of Greater New York. Obvious reasons why this stuff is starting in New York, which is?
The Russians.
That's where the Jews are, and that's where the Russians are. That's where the critical mass is. You know, that's where the most Jews were and are. You know, I often wonder what some of these early immigrants would think if they came today and they stumbled on, in, like I said, in Brooklyn, 300,000, you know, Hasidic Jews. You know, they would wonder which country they really came to in many regards. All right. So the Society, the Federation of Zionist Societies of Greater New York had 24 groups and 1,000 members. That's in 1897. 3 years later, 1900, they have 152 groups and 8,000 members, and they have their national conference the next year. And guess where their national conference is? Baltimore. Right, they had to take it on the road. Today, by the way, the Federation of American Zionists is the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America. Not what it was by any stretch of the imagination, but still an important player in national Jewish life. Has a seat in what's called the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, which is the main decision-making body of American Jewish life. BZD is an offshoot of ZOA. Was anybody here involved with that? When BZD broke off? No? It, about 1991, I think it was, the folks at the ZOA chapter in Baltimore didn't like the direction the organization was going under Morton Klein, its president for life, as according to him. So they broke off and formed something called the Baltimore Zionist District. There is still, I believe, a small ZOA chapter of loyalists here in Baltimore, or at least there was for a while. But that's kind of the organizational underpinnings of all that.
What didn't they like about the way it was?
They felt that he was criticizing the government of Israel too much. This is, I said 91, it was probably 93 then, when the peace process started.
So that's when Baltimore Zionist
Yeah. The mantra...
I thought it was much earlier than that for some reason.
I don't think so, but I know Jimmy Schiller was the guy behind it.
He's the new president for life.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah, it just... Self-appointed. He's married to my former aunt, so I can't really say anything about it.
Okay. A duly noted.
The mantra had always been for American Jewish organizations, and you know, not quite so much in the early days because it wasn't an issue, but the mantra has always been, we don't criticize the democratically elected government of the state of Israel. All right, that's for the people in Israel to do. You know, our job is to lobby on its behalf. As long as it's a democratically elected government in the state of Israel, we support it. And that's certainly the line that AIPAC takes and other groups take. So when Israel said, we're going to give land for peace, Mr. Klein disagreed with that notion vehemently and let it be known, and that upset certain people. And then there was alleged election maneuvering and all that. It was fine Jewish organizational intrigue. Fine Jewish organizational intrigue. All right. So this was a grouping of Hove Tzion activists and Jewish nationalist clubs that all endorsed the Basel program. Anybody remember the Basel program? That's from the 1897. The Basel program basically said, we believe that the Jews should return to the land of Israel. You know, in highfalutin terminology. They published a monthly magazine called The Maccabean. I've actually seen old copies of it. It's really neat. You know, you have reports from various the ones I saw were kibbutzim and settlements, and you have, like, just like you would expect, mini profiles of certain leaders and facts about Jaffa oranges and all fun stuff like that. It's just wonderful to find that, and a lot of people have these things in their attics, I've learned over the years. All right, Rabbi Richard Gotthill was elected president, and Rabbi Stephen S. Wise was named honorary secretary. We're going to talk about Wise in a little bit, but he was one of the preeminent figures of American Zionist life as well as American Jewish life from really around 1900 until his death in 1948. But still, they faced this opposition. Jacob Schiff, who was a well-noted philanthropist, would say Zionism would foster a separateness that would be fatal. And Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, who was the dean of the Reform Movement in this country, this is my favorite quote, said, "We think it about as well to let the old Jerusalem rest under the accretion of ages as it is described in the Bible and Josephus. The consequences to mankind cannot be found under the rubbish of 2,000 years." So, nonetheless, something was beginning to happen. There was an organizational root that was taking place in communities around the country, and this was a direct offshoot of what was happening over in Europe. Remember, Zionism was taking off like wildfire in Europe. Herzl had created this great pageant, invited all the leading journalists of the day, there were articles everywhere, there was intellectual ferment, people were taking sides, they were, you know, threatening to leave the organization. It was an exciting thing. In a very American way, things were beginning to happen. And with that, we'll take a break.